Welcome, listeners, to another episode of Beyond the Unknown. I'm your host, Jolie.
And I'm Quinn.
And today, we're covering a tragic case of domestic abuse and a missing person found in the bottom of a pond in Alberta. How are the two situations related? Who was the perpetrator? Who was the victim? Stay tuned to find out.
Content warning for today's episode. Please be aware that this episode contains discussion about domestic abuse, which may be traumatizing for some of our listeners. If you or someone you know is suffering from abuse, please visit the Government of Canada website for resources based on geographical location and specific types of abuse. We will put this link on our website and on our social media posts pertaining to this episode.
And we'll link it in the episode description too, in case you need it.
So I'm bringing us back to Eastern rural Alberta once again, and a small town called Holden. So if you check out our social media, I put a map to show how close this area is to the capital city of Edmonton, and there you'll see outlined the county of Beaver County, which is where Holden is located. So once I started uncovering a few interesting stories in this area, Eastern Alberta, I just kept finding more and more. If you're new here and haven't heard me drone on and on about rural Alberta yet, these communities are primarily supported by the agricultural industry, where most people are either farmers or in some way, shape, or form have a connection to farming and agriculture, or a lot of people do still leave their homes in these rural communities and go work in the oil industry, usually up north. Farms are varied, but typically either have grain farming and cattle farming or a mix of both. For grain farmers, every late summer and early fall is a make-or-break situation. This is when the monumental task of harvest takes place. If the weather had cooperated, you will have had enough rain, but not too much, and enough sun, but not too hot, and your grain will be plentiful. If not, and the weather was too harsh or too dry, as Alberta's climate typically is, your harvest return could be somewhat dismal. What you make in harvest, in turn, dictates how you, one, make a living, two, pay off any debts you would have accrued to actually put in the grain and fund your farm, and three, if you also have livestock on your farm, this money would help to support that section of your business as well. So it's at a crucial time of year, and it's pretty stressful for people if things aren't going well. So why am I going on and on about this? Well, this is an integral part of our next story about the Naslin family. The Naslin family consisted of Helen and her husband Miles and their three sons, Wesley, Daryl, and Neil. In Holden, for the Naslin family, their livelihood depended on this relatively uncontrollable situation on their farm, and they were at the mercy, as all farmers are, of Mother Nature. They also farmed sections of land that weren't particularly the best quality, and this really matters. If you have better quality land, your crop can thrive under some pretty harsh conditions. Unfortunately, time and time again, this family was let down, and the crop yields were simply not enough to cover the debts and feed the family, and they are at risk of losing their livestock. In order for them to make ends meet, Helen worked as a manager at an equipment rental company nearby. From the outside, it seemed as though their story was similar to so many in the area, but what was happening behind closed doors was very dark and evil, and it is rumored that the entire community was reasonably aware of what was happening, and no one stepped in to help.
Oh.
So why don't we start back from the beginning and get to know Helen Naslin and the life as she knew it until the age of 41. Helen's maiden name was Speed, so before she was Helen Naslin. She was born in 1964 and was the youngest of eight children. Her parents, somewhat aloof and unaffectionate as many were in that generation, operated a dairy farm in central Alberta. Life wasn't always easy though, and the family moved around a lot to try to make a go of their farming. Her parents were, however, dedicated to their family regardless. Helen kept to herself mostly, but she was known to be very hardworking. At 16, Helen moved to Camrose, which is a somewhat larger rural town just southeast of Edmonton, to make a life of her own. She got a job working in a mall cafeteria. So Camrose, I just went there today, actually, wow. For the second time in my life to go get some feed. For a rural Alberta town, I think it's like huge. I was blown away. There's a Shoppers Drug Mart. There's all the big box grocery stores. There's chain restaurants. And like the rest of Alberta, you don't, like rural Alberta anyways, you don't see that. But their population's about 20,000.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And the catchment's like a little bit bigger than that in terms of the surrounding towns. But when she would have moved there, it wouldn't have been quite that big. Like, a lot of the growth happened kind of in the 90s. At 18, Helen met and married 21-year-old Miles Naslin. Helen didn't seem to have much of a choice in the matter, though. Apparently, Miles saw her and he just decided he wanted to get to know her and basically followed her around until she agreed to go out with him.
Ew.
Yeah, it's really weird. Then she started spending most of her nights at his trailer. Then he sold his trailer and moved into her apartment in Camrose. This made Helen a little uneasy, actually, because she didn't really want to be tied down by a guy. She just finally had gotten free of her family and was kind of doing her own thing. She had pretty big dreams. She wanted to be a paramedic, and she eventually wanted to operate her own farm.
Wow.
She tried to leave him, but he flew off the handle and kind of pulled a really nasty guilt trip and was like, I don't have anywhere to go. No one loves me. No one cares about me. And Helen, having a pretty big heart, was like, oh, okay, you know, let him stay. One thing led to another, and the pair had only been together a few months, and they tied the knot in 1983.
A few months?
Uh-huh.
Oh, my God.
I know. Helen figured, even if they weren't a perfect match, their farm-owning goals at least lined up. I guess he wanted to do that, too. After marriage, Miles started to become more and more controlling. Shortly after they were wed, she gave birth to her first son and would later give birth to two more. She was described as a very happy and joyful woman. She had hobbies and interests. She was an avid barrel racer and would compete in rodeo events. But eventually she sold her horses, gave up competing, and stopped going out altogether. Apparently she had stayed out a little too late one night after barrel racing, and Miles flew off the handle. So she had to sell her horse and stop barrel racing altogether.
Oh my God.
Eventually the neighbors stopped calling and visiting. Children no longer allowed to come over to play on the Naslin farm. And even Helen's parents stopped the frequency of their visits and only came once a year. So what was really going on there? What was driving people away? So to kind of set the stage for the first part of the couple's marriage, we should probably talk about the economy in the 1980s. Although Alberta was like booming, the oil industry was huge, the 1980s is when like the economy like worldwide took this massive downturn and interest rates just spiked. Like they were outrageous. So like now. Way worse. So if you weren't paying off your debt, like, so for example, like what I was talking about before, if your farm wasn't making enough like financial advancement and you were farming in debt and not paying off those loans, you were accruing like massive debt on top of your debt, like in terms of the interest rates. So that financial strain obviously took a toll on just how they lived their lives. And as you know, all of us know, financial stuff can be stressful and it can take a toll on marriage, interpersonal relationships, your sleep, mental health, like everything. So Miles had a temper and like just because of all of that and just maybe his nature as well, he just turned to alcohol more and more and more. The more he drank, the more rageful, cruel, and belligerent he became. Sometime in the 90s, he bought a 357 Magnum gun, I don't know what that means, which he kept loaded, and he either had it like on himself or next to him at all times.
Is that legal? Was it legal then?
Like, not if you're out of your house. I think it was just in his house. I think theoretically you're supposed to, if you have a license, you can have a gun in your house. I think it just has to be like locked up and secured. So I guess like in theory, no. He just wouldn't have been able to be walking around town with it like that. I'm not actually sure.
Mm-hmm.
Most might not see owning a firearm as a weird thing on a farm, but farmers typically use their weapons to protect their livestock from prey. And this isn't how Miles was ever described as using his. This was a weapon of control he used on his own family members.
Well, this sounds like a really, like a handgun.
Yeah, like it's not like a rifle.
Yeah.
I don't know. It just the way that the Magnum, like it sounds little.
Well, let me Google it, girl.
Let's look it up.
Does Chris have a handgun?
No. No, no.
Oh my God, this looks like a revolver. It is a revolver.
You actually need a very special type of license for that type of gun, and it's even getting further restricted now, so not a lot of people will have those. But at the time, it was just a broad one, and he could have had that type of gun under the same type of general license.
Oh.
So, yeah, he had this gun and he wielded it around the house and he would threaten to kill his family members and actually more commonly threatened to use it to kill himself.
Oh,
it was a very like psychologically abusive situation. So in both Helen's and her son's accounts, she had been abused physically and psychologically pretty much throughout her entire marriage.
And before, she was coerced into getting married.
Yeah, in my mind, that was like psychological abuse.
Yeah.
The physical abuse apparently didn't start till a little bit later, but yeah. Helen worked at and outside of her home to keep the bills paid. When she was outside of the house, Miles demanded to have like an exact like play-by-play of exactly where she went, who she was talking to, how long she stayed there, because he was just so controlling. She was not allowed to really leave the house without him except to go to work. So if she was like there a little too long, like it was just like, who are you talking to? What are you doing? When she would come home from work, she had to cook dinner for the family. She would tend to all the farm chores. And from what I can tell, they had like livestock and grain. So lots of chores. Like that in of itself is a full-time job. There's stories of her doing, you know, when people have their cows are calving, like what we do in the spring. You have to go out all hours of the night to just check, just to see on any like, you know, cows that are about to give birth, or if babies have been born, if they're too wet and cold, go dry them off. Helen did this throughout her entire marriage to him. Even when she'd have like little like newborn babies, she'd be running out in like the minus 30.
That's crazy.
Miles did nothing. Miles would threaten her at gunpoint or beat her if she didn't start cooking soon enough.
Holy shit.
He would say things like, if you don't start effing cooking supper, I'll effing kill you. She couldn't even so much as make an independent decision regarding what food to make. Once she apparently made macaroni twice in 1 week and he beat her up for that.
Oh my God.
He's even known to have locked her in a room for 1 to 2 days with her in that room and her sons out of the room without her at gunpoint of the dad. So that's like the ultimate form of torture to a mother, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Because the abuse didn't really stop with Helen, the sons were abused as well. Not all of them equally, though. I think the middle son, Daryl, had a somewhat closer relationship with the dad, but the oldest and the youngest were definitely at the hands of his beatings many times. Her sons would often get caught up in the altercations in an effort to save their mother from getting beaten up, especially as they got older. One of her sons recalls many swollen eyes and split lips in an effort to protect her.
Aww.
He recalls her often being punched in the chest or the stomach or shoved to the ground. And at one point, her son Wes, he recalls he had gotten in trouble at school or something and his dad like beat him with a bullwhip, and he still has like all the scars on the back of his neck from that.
Holy shit.
Helen tried to stop Miles, but I guess she was a really tiny woman, like barely 100 pounds. So there just was never anything she could ever do. But yeah, I won't go into that part too much more because it's awful. I think you get the picture. Like he was just scum of the earth. But people are probably thinking, and I hate when people say this, why didn't she leave him? That's the worst thing you could say. That's the most dated thing. And without getting into all the reasons of why women who are abused don't leave, Helen did try to leave. She once actually had everything set, packed to go. The husband shoved her into her bedroom, and when she came out, her son said she was crying, and she said, I can't leave. He's going to find us, and he's going to kill us. So then Helen had tried to kill herself many times.
Wow.
One time, she almost succeeded, but she didn't. She lived, and honestly, that learned helplessness, she really was truly helpless. He was threatening her, like at gunpoint, and her kids, so she didn't have anywhere to go or anything she could do. So she stayed. So fast forward to the Labor Day long weekend in 2011. This is one of the busiest times on the farm, as we talked about before. This is harvest, right smack in the middle of it. Helen returned home from work to find Miles drunk on the couch. So rather than working out on the field, he had sat on his ass and done absolutely nothing all day. He awoke from his drunken stupor, grabbed his gun, and ordered Helen and their youngest son to go finish all the farm work. And he started throwing wrenches at her and tools and like beating on her basically until she went to go do this farm work. So Helen and her son did as they were told. Even though she was tired from a long day work at her other job, she continued to do this work through the day, the next day. And that night, after working the farm 2 straight days and her other job without help from Miles, Helen set to cooking their dinner as she always had. She set the meal on the table and laid out the food, and then Miles came over to inspect it and violently shoved all the plates and cutlery and food to the floor and said the meal wasn't fit for a dog. He then continued to threaten and harass Helen and her 2 adult sons living at the home. It wasn't until he passed out that night that the family finally got a break from his relentless abuse. That night, Helen retrieved a .22 caliber revolver stored in a cabinet in their farmhouse. She went to her marital bedroom where Miles was sleeping, and she shot him in the back of the head. She ended his life, finally putting an end to the 26-year-long history of abuse. This has been written about in so many places, like in, you remember Chatelaine?
Yeah, the magazine, right?
Yeah, like all kinds of stories have done write-ups on this. I had no idea.
Wow.
Helen went to the basement to wake her 19-year-old son, Neil. Daryl, the middle son, was asleep in the basement too, but he wasn't woken by his mom. Miles and Daryl, as I described earlier, were kind of close, so maybe that's why she didn't wake him up, but she never really says, and it's never really talked about why. Together, Neil and Helen pulled the body from the bedroom and somehow got it inside of a large metal toolbox. They then added weights to the toolbox and welded it shut. Then they dragged the toolbox out to a slough on the property, so this is like kind of a shallow pond.
Mm-hmm.
They then tossed the toolbox and watched it sink out of sight. Helen then took the bloodied items from the bedroom and burned them. Working for an equipment rental company, Helen was able to get an excavator from her work and she used it to bury Miles' car. Neil and Helen then went to tell her son Wes, so that's the older son who wasn't living at the home at the time, what happened. On September 6, 2 days following Miles' murder, Helen reported him missing. The story was given that Miles had left the farm in his car to go buy a part that they needed for the farm, and he never returned. It was implied that he probably actually just went and killed himself. And this is genuinely something he frequently threatened to do. He was also well known to be a drunken asshole in the town. So it was rumored that no one was really sad to see that he was missing. There was no missing posters put up. There was no community search parties. I don't think the police looked too hard into it. It was kind of like, good riddance, you son of a... Anyways.
So what happened to the middle son? Was he not like, where's my dad and why do you have this excavator?
So they didn't tell him, but they assumed he knew, but it was just sort of never really talked about.
Okay.
So they kind of told him the story like, oh, he's gone, even though they knew he probably knew what they had really been up to.
Yeah. Okay.
That's the vibe I got from it because they just don't talk about him a lot. So over the next many years, Helen and her sons kept the secret about what really happened on September 4th, 2011. They maintained the story that he left one day and never returned. Meanwhile, Helen worked several jobs around town and the secret was kept. And for 6 years, Helen was finally free. Unfortunately, though, Helen's peaceful existence was once again about to be turned upside down. And in 2017, the middle son, Daryl, told the RCMP. So when I first wrote this story, there's a lot of rumors that he actually just spoke about it at a bar and told people there, and then it got back to the RCMP.
Mm-hmm.
But in looking at like very recent publications on like people talking to Helen, it was actually the son that just directly told the RCMP. Obviously, the RCMP had to go investigate, and there they uncovered the metal toolbox from inside the slough, and inside they found his decomposed body. After a couple days, Helen and Neil turned themselves in. Helen was charged with first-degree murder, but later pled guilty to a lesser charge of manslaughter. Neither lawyer, the defense, or the opposite of the defense, I don't know.
Prosecution, maybe? I don't know.
Yes. Neither the defense or the prosecution brought up the fact that she was an abused woman, but instead they just focused on the indignity done to the body. And in choosing the length of Helen's sentence, there was absolutely zero mention of her 30 years of being a victim, but instead said, and I quote, this is about Helen, this was a callous, cowardly act on a vulnerable victim in his own home, so his domicile by a partner.
Why was he vulnerable?
Right? Like, none of that makes any sense. Their thing is she shot him while he was sleeping, so he was a vulnerable victim.
Oh.
Yeah. So she was given an 18-year sentence for killing this man. But Helen agreed to this also because if she did, there would be a lesser sentence on the son that helped her.
Aww.
Now, the 18-year sentence is and was at the time seen as extremely harsh. No one considered her history abuse, not even her own lawyer. It was messed up. Additionally, sometime in the 90s, a law passed in which battered women syndrome was a thing that was supposed to be considered in these types of court cases, and it often led to a reduced penalty for women who killed their abusive partners, because often they were killing the partners to save their lives. But the judge here said it wasn't relevant. The lawyer defending her even said, and I quote, he struggled to use the battered woman angle in the case.
I find that weird because you said this is like 2011 and probably happened like, wait, it's way later that she was getting charged.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you're talking about the 80s still.
I know. Like, it's messed up. Luckily, Helen's case and her 18-year sentence sparked outrage across the nation. She was a woman who was a victim of abuse, and she was questioned by male officers, male detectives, represented by and prosecuted by men. Judge was a male, the jury were men. So a petition was organized by a grassroots advocacy group called Women Who Choose to Live, and over 18,000 signatures were collected by 2021. Another petition in Ontario got over 25,000 signatures, and there was a lot going around on social media with like the hashtag Stand With Helen. There were many factors that caused that outrage, but one being that zero focus on the fact that she was a battered woman. The sentencing judge also focused heavily on her use of a firearm, but this was countered by the fact that men often kill women with their bare hands by strangulation. Most women often can't overpower a man due to their size and strength imbalance. Thus, a weapon is usually a woman's only means of defense. They also pointed out that there should have been more emphasis on whether or not that weapons in the house had been used against the woman. And they had. He had been using that gun for years to threaten her. Another noteworthy point is on the matter of prior convictions for intimate partner murder. So in Canada, since the COVID-19 pandemic, a woman is killed by her partner every 2.3 days.
Whoa.
Which was way higher than before, but even then it used to be every 6 days. And in 90% of these cases, when the killer is, you know, determined, it's a man. Some of these men, though, received far lesser sentences than Helen. So these are men that were violent offenders, abusing the shit out of someone, and then eventually killed that person. So at no point were they a victim, getting lesser sentences than Helen. So in 2017, a guy choked his wife to death and got 8 years.
Oh.
Remember, Helen got 18. And then another guy in Alberta, same province, murdered his wife and then cemented her in the basement, and he got 7 years.
What?
Yeah. And in 86, there was a woman who shot her husband in the back of the head with a gun after an altercation and many, many, many years of her being abused by him. And a jury decided that she shouldn't be charged with any of it. So it just seemed like Helen's case just didn't follow suit with absolutely anything that had happened.
Wow.
Finally, in February 2021, Helen asked the Alberta Court of Appeal to review her case. When the case was reviewed, Helen's sentence was reduced by half to 9 years, minus the time already served. Additionally, Helen was acknowledged to clearly have not been an entrenched criminal, and she showed excellent behavior throughout her time served, and thus had been granted unescorted 72-hour absences from the prison. In 2022, she was granted day parole. When she is eventually released, she will live with her sister Sharon and her friend, whose name is Guy Turnbull, I think. He actually saved her job for her at the rental company.
Aww.
He's been a good friend to her throughout all of this. He paid all of her defense fees and everything, and like even bought her farm from her, like so she'd have that money. So,
wow.
Very good friend. And so when she's out, it sounds like she's going to be okay. But there you have it, the story of Helen Naslin, forced to take matters into her own hands to do something that would likely ultimately save her life. I feel like if she didn't do it, she might be dead.
Yeah.
I just wanted to note that, to come back to the idea of like, why didn't she just leave him? It's an outdated view. And like, often I don't think people consider the degree of like the psychological abuse that goes on, and that making someone believe that they're not capable of leaving and that they're worthless and that they can't make it without them. Like, that's such a big part of it. There is often an element of financial abuse, as well as making it very challenging for a woman to leave. So, you know, you have no money, nowhere to go, no, potentially you're living pretty isolated, and you don't have any friends or family you could go live with. So that's another component of it. And I want to just point out and just leave everyone with this final thought. The highest risk of being murdered by your abusive partner is in that first 18 months after you leave them. The violence escalates, and that's usually when someone gets killed. But we'll just leave you with that thought. If you or someone you know is a victim of abuse, we strongly encourage you to visit the Government of Canada website for regional resources. We have put that link on our website and our social posts.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Beyond the Unknown. If you have a story you'd like to share, please email us at moody.mediaprod@gmail.com. You can reach out on our website, and who knows, your story might be featured in our next episode.
All of our sources for this episode could be found on our website, beyondtheunknownpod.com. And don't forget, if you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave us a review.
Until next time, listeners, stay curious and remember that the unknown is always just beyond the shadows.
Bye.